Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 84. My name is Karen.
Hi, I'm Kristen.
Was that a question?
I don't know.
Okay, so we only skipped a week, but I'm already like, what do I do? I feel rusty. I can't remember how this goes.
How do I do any of this?
It was, also, life is chaotic right now. I guess this is as good a time as any to tell you that what we said we were going to do in last week's episode, we lied to you.
We absolutely did not lie. We intended it to be about Last Canto of the Dead, but because of some craziness and just timing and everything, we're going to be just doing a news and a chapter of The Red Pyramid today. So I know we didn't warn you, and you probably haven't read this chapter of The Last Pyramid, so here's your notice. Pause this. Go read it. It's only a chapter, and it's a short one.
It's a short one.
And then come back, because it'll be fine. Yeah. I promise.
I really like giving, like, you know, the listeners heads up to, like, what we're going to do next week, so that they know and can get excited and stuff like that, but, like, especially in this industry and when you're trying to, like, coordinate with other people. And, like, I just got back from a vacation, and I feel like it took me way longer to get back to the real world after that. And I feel like I'm, you know, already running at full speed. So things got a little complicated, but we have a lot of good things coming.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'll do the best we can to bring them all to you, even if they're a little out of order.
I was going to say, we will talk about Last Canto of the Dead eventually.
For sure, yeah.
It's not going to be this week, and it's not going to be next week.
That's true.
And if you read the book, good job. You're ahead of the game. If you didn't have time to read it, and you were planning to, and, you know, life got in the way, you have an extension. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so we will definitely keep you guys updated throughout and let you know when things will happen, and we'll try not to unintentionally lie to you again.
It's not a lie if life has forced it to change.
Yes,
that's which is pretty much what
very true. If you would like to complain to us, I guess you could do that. If you would like to tell us that you missed us, you could also do that.
Aww.
By contacting us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. The majority of this episode, like Kristen said, is going to be about news and updates, which is good because we took a week off and there are some things to discuss, and some of them are, like, worth a longer discussion.
Yeah.
So, plus, we had a super-sized episode last week.
We did.
So, if this one ends up being a little shorter, I'm not going to be mad about it.
Yeah.
But I wanted to kick it off, of course, with The Sun and the Star, which is still going strong on the New York Times best-selling books list. It is at 4 weeks now, which I feel like surprises only Mark. Like, everybody else is like, yeah, no, this makes sense. It's a new Percy Jackson book. Why wouldn't it be on top of the New York Times bestsellers list? But
Mark is experiencing this for the first time,
yes,
and it's delightful.
I'm so glad that they get to call themselves New York Times bestselling author now.
Well, and
they deserve it.
And with a book that's openly queer from the get-go, like, there was no hidden thing. It's not a Percy Jackson book that we find out a character is gay in,
this
or whatever.
This book is gay.
Yeah, like, it's a gay book. And for it to be doing as well as it is, I'm sure that also feels very different and is probably extra special for Mark.
Yeah, I'm really excited for that. Speaking of The Sun and the Star, Becky tweeted out a current list of The Sun and the Star international publishing partners. And we have, you know, international rights for Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Germany, France. I'm trying to, like, translate some of these. Italy, Poland, Spain, all that kind of stuff. So I'll link to that tweet in case you missed it, but then you'll be able to see specifically who's publishing the book, and then you can go to their website to see when the international on sale date will be, because a lot of international countries don't have those books yet. And in fact, some of them are just releasing, like, the title, the translated title, and the cover for the first time, which I think just happened to the Italian edition very recently.
Yeah.
I also wanted to hand the reins over to Kristen for a little bit, because you had a really cool little exchange with Becky on Twitter while I was gone about Libby and the fact that they have a dyslexic font option. And we are both huge fans of the Libby app.
Yes, I was a bigger fan of the previous Overdrive app, but it's dead, so I'm letting it go. The Libby app is the same thing as Overdrive. So if you used to use Overdrive and you're like, what is this Libby nonsense? It's the same thing, it's just a little flashier. For me, I've had some issues with things I used to be able to do in search that I can't do as easily now. Like, I used to really easily be able to figure out like what books my library didn't have. It's harder to make requests in the new, in the Libby app, which is my only real criticism.
And that's basically what Overdrive and Libby is, right? Like, it's just an app for, like, you to request books from your library.
Books, audiobooks. I think they also do, like, magazines and, like, graphic novel kinds of things. Like, anything that you're reading or listening to in book form, yeah, you can borrow from Libby.
Okay.
And it's pretty great. I mean, different, different libraries have different sized collections. It all depends on what your library has purchased. But because it's all online, like, a lot of states allow you to hold multiple library cards. So, like, my personal library, the one in my city, doesn't necessarily always have everything that I'm looking for. But I, since we're in Ohio, I also have library cards for Cleveland and Columbus and Cincinnati and Youngstown and Dayton. And so, therefore, I'm able to access their catalogs of books and stuff. And
do you know how many library cards you have?
I only, because Libby has all of them in one place, I think I have 7.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And I don't, none of them are out of state. I don't have to pay for any of them. They're all just free because I live in Ohio, so I have all the Ohio ones. I know there used to be one, like the Brooklyn one, I believe, that you, Brooklyn, New York library, that you could buy like a year subscription to for like $50 or something. I think they recently changed that and you can't do it from out of state anymore.
Oh.
But there are other like major systems. I think the Houston Library in Texas lets you like pay a small fee to use it from out of state. That sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole point of this discussion was that Becky shared somebody's post talking about how Libby has a dyslexic font, which I just had never noticed, thought of, was not something that I was aware of. I usually do most of my borrowing from Libby. I borrow, like, the Kindle book, so it opens in my Kindle app, so I don't think twice about it. But you can borrow, like, EPUB books and things through Libby, and so it opens up in the Libby app.
Okay.
And when you're in the Libby app, you can change the fonts, obviously, like you can on a Kindle. And there's a dyslexic font that has different weight to the text, so, like, the bottoms of the text are thicker so that your eye doesn't get drawn, like, things don't move around as much.
Yeah.
And I just think it's so cool. Like, technology is awesome.
It is.
And to find a way to make reading more accessible and easier for people who have dyslexia, I just think it's really awesome, and it fits so well with everything Percy Jackson is and believes in, that I was like, they would all find this so fascinating. Like, I could just see Annabeth getting, like, that much more excited, because she's a huge reader, and to be able to read even easier, like, that would make her life so much better.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just thought it was really cool, and one more thing that Libby is doing to make life awesome.
Yeah.
I love that.
I've been actually using Libby a bunch lately because I have been listening to the audiobook versions of books that I've already read, partly to, like, help me fall asleep and partly because I just love the books. And I was like, yeah, I'll listen to these. Like, I'll experience them in a new format. And it's just nice because, you know, it's free, and it's good to support libraries and stuff like that, and especially, like, if you are struggling to be able to finance, for example, all of the Rick Riordan Presents books, because there are a ton of them.
Yes, there are.
There are so many.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we have a book count. I'll have to look that up, because there's a bunch of them. But getting them through your library, and specifically the Libby app, which is free to download, will allow you to experience them and then not have to shell out the money if you can't.
Absolutely. And I've seen this question a lot in some of my, like, readers groups on Facebook or whatever. Authors do get paid for reads in Libby. Just like Hoopla, which is a whole different app. Borrowing from them for free is not the same as stealing it off the internet.
Yes.
The library has to pay a fee to host that ebook or audiobook on their Libby server or whatever. And so you are absolutely helping your authors by listening to it on mm-hmm. Libby or reading a book from Libby. If you can't afford to buy it yourself, it's the perfect way to both support your author, support your library, and also get to read the book and mm-hmm. not have to shell out $25 and $30 for every hardcover, because I can't afford that either.
Yeah.
Plus, with me, I'm also an audiobook listener, and audiobooks get expensive fast.
They are so expensive.
So I love, especially with the RRP books, they are usually in demand at one of the libraries I have a library card for, and so I'm usually able to request or put a hold on an audiobook mm-hmm. so that when it comes out, I have a copy really quick and can use that as I listen and read together, because I usually do a little mixture of both.
Yeah.
So yeah, Libby is such a wonderful tool, and I just love that they're being more inclusive and trying really hard to help everybody be able to use that. Because I don't know for sure, but I've heard that it can be harder for people with, like, dyslexia to read on screens, too. Like, like sometimes it can get harder because it's straining on your eyes, plus you're trying to, you know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know that for sure. I'm not an expert. But I've heard that, and so to make it easier for people to be able to read ebooks and things just makes it all better, because ebooks are a lot lighter than carrying six books in your bag on vacation.
Yeah, I just brought my Kindle on vacation, and I was like, thank goodness I didn't have to pack, like, because I used to, on vacation, pack, you know, 3-4 books and some, and, like, those get heavy, so.
I always bring one, because technology fails me. Bring one real book and then my Kindle, and that's usually all I need. And I've had to use my backup book before, but it's rare.
But yeah, I mean, just to reiterate what you said earlier, I'm sure they're out there, because there are all kinds of people out there, but I have never personally met an author who isn't a huge proponent of libraries. And so, you know, don't feel guilty about not being able to buy a book. Like, even if you're the one who puts the initial request in for that book, that helps a lot, too, at the library. So
I've done that a lot.
Yeah.
Less now, because the Libby app is trying to stop me. It's working against me. But I used to, especially, request stuff all the time, and it just lets them know what people are looking for. It's not a guarantee that they're going to get everything you request, but a lot of the stuff I requested came through within a month or so. So a lot of times it really is helpful, and it saves you a buck too when you're trying to budget and worrying about all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Support the library.
Yeah, it's very cool. Okay, next item on the list that is related to The Son and the Star is that, thank goodness, Mark posted their little drawings that they did of the end pages, where Stephanie Lurie asked them to draw basically a map for the book. And so they were like, I can't draw, but sure. And this is what I was talking about during the tour. And I'm so glad that they posted these online, because they are delightful. And I won't talk about the stuff, like, at the very end, because that's still, like, spoilers, and I know some people are still reading them. But I wanted to just, like, point out a few things, because I think I mentioned this on that episode where you see Hades' palace, and it just says, ah, suffering! And that really made me laugh. And then an arrow pointing, saying, more suffering! I also really liked Persephone. Imagine she is pretty. And Menoides, please don't judge. That one was definitely one of my favorites.
I could have drawn this. This is what things look like when I draw.
Yeah, it's like, all stick figures and squiggles.
Yeah, but like Persephone's hair, that's how my hair always looked in drawing. So I love that. I love it so much.
I mean, to be fair, this is actually fairly detailed, like, in terms of, like, the places that they stop, even if the actual drawings themselves. I just saw the hut empty and sad. I actually hadn't noticed that before. That really makes me laugh. That is so funny.
Yeah, it's good fun.
Yeah.
There are spoilers on this, so if you have not yet read Sun and the Star, what are you doing? But also, don't look at this too closely.
Yeah. I love that Mark says, please tag yourself. I'm imagine she is pretty.
I'm really impressed by their ability to give Amphithemis all those legs.
Right? I was actually very impressed by that as well.
It's good stuff.
It's just really fun to
look at. And the journey through swamp. That's Small Bob.
Yes.
I love Small Bob.
Yeah. Very cute.
Yeah. It's delightful. And again, it's one of those things where you look at it from time to time and you'll notice something new and be delighted all over again.
Yeah. I really like it. I'm glad they posted that.
Yeah.
Apparently, this is a bit random, but I figured Becky tweeted it, so I might as well mention it. Apparently, Rick finally got COVID. After all of these years, and he's been so careful and everything, and it wasn't the book tour. No, it wasn't, you know, meeting all of those people and all of those press interviews. No. It was going to a Taylor Swift concert.
Friggin' Taylor Swift.
Apparently, her concert, the Eras Tour, has been magnificent.
Oh, I've seen so much of it, and I have definitely not shelled out $1,300 for a ticket.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that we're living in the age of the internet where people put clips, enough clips, and whole concert recordings up on the on the internet, so I can feel like I'm there.
Yeah, exactly. But, I just love that Rick went to a Taylor Swift concert.
Right?
Like, did he go by himself? Did Becky go with him? Did he go with his kids?
Well, like, I feel like this was talked about for a minute. I think him and Becky went.
Oh, okay.
Because somebody was talking about how there's no possible chance that they didn't get recognized. And, like, how many Swifties... Like, there's gotta be crossover.
There is crossover.
Between Swifties and Rick Riordan, and Rick Riordan fans. So I'm like, how many people recognize them? I don't know if they just got random seats. Like, were they up in the nosebleeds? Like, we don't know anything about where they sat for this. But, yeah, it was really cute because a lot of people were talking about, like, how, you know, who recognized Rick? Which one was he at? Where were they? But,
yeah,
I think there was talk that it was him and Becky that went.
I feel like if he got, like, backstage passes, he definitely would have posted about that.
Well, did he get to sit in the, like, celebrity
right,
tent is my question. Because, like, he's Rick Riordan.
Yeah.
Like, that's not nothing. Like, you know, so I'm curious if maybe they got to sit in the tent.
Yeah.
And if somebody more famous was there that day, cameras and people would have probably been drawn to that. You know, I can't stop seeing pictures of Aaron Rodgers enjoying Taylor Swift all over my feed. I do not care about Aaron Rodgers. But people, like, there were other people there that day, and all they talk about is that one person.
Yeah.
So they may have slipped by without having to.
I also, and I mean, obviously, I do not know Rick and Becky that well, but I also feel like they would just sit in a regular seat.
Right? They
like,
would.
They would just buy regular tickets.
They would buy a pair of tickets and go.
Yeah.
I 100% agree. By the way, this also happened in my family. My mother just got COVID a couple weeks ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Is she
and
doing okay?
Yeah, she's fine.
Okay.
It's basically, she's passed it. She's got, like, the remnants of a sinus infection now, which is kind of, it happens. But it was kind of funny because it happened right around the same time.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Rick got COVID and so did my mother. And I was like, I'm just...
Were they in the same room together?
Right.
Did she go to the Taylor Swift concert?
Not that I know of, but if she did, she is dead to me.
Yeah, I would have been so
she
mad.
Went without me, I would be pissed.
Yeah. But we really hope Rick feels better soon, and hopefully it's not too bad of a case. I know he's, like, you know, vaccinated and boosted and all of that, so hopefully it's not too bad. And hopefully Becky, I think she's had it before, because Rick didn't get
familiar.
It. Yeah, but hopefully she doesn't get sick either. This next bit of news is really, really, really exciting to me, even though I have not been able to dive into it yet. But thanks to Publishers Marketplace, they have a sort of, like, look-ahead thing where you can read excerpts, like whole chapters from, or a whole chapter from upcoming books. They have it for a lot of different kinds of books, but specifically to us, what's important to us is they have a chapter from A Drop of Venom by Sajani Patel, which is the young adult, like, Medusa-ish retelling, and then The Spirit Glass by Roshni Chokshi, which is her Filipino story. and you can read them for free. Anybody can read them. I downloaded them via NetGalley, but there's like four or five options to download them, and you can check out like upcoming big titles. So,
and these are just excerpts. It's not the whole book. It's just like
right. I think it's just a chapter. Yeah, probably the opening chapter. I would imagine. But
that's still cool.
It is, and I'm like, I mean, obviously, I was already invested in Rosh's book. Like, that's a no-brainer. But I'm really excited to see what A Drop of Venom is going to be like.
And that one doesn't come out until next January.
Right, yeah. Yeah,
so, like, that one, get a taste now and you'll kind of, you know, you can plan ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to make a joke about get a taste and A Drop of Venom and, like, building up your resistance. And I can't quite get there, but I just want you to know that, like, it was stewing.
The cogs were working. Yeah. Just couldn't quite make it there in time.
Okay, and then, of course, Last Canto of the Dead by Daniel Jose Older is officially out in the world. It came out on May 16th. Yes, we were supposed to talk about it today, but that's okay. I had therapy today, so we are giving grace to the things that we cannot accomplish on time. It's totally fine. But you can read my review, which Daniel liked.
Yeah.
It made me very happy.
That was cute.
He quoted it. And it's good because they're, you know, I've talked about this with the last book as well, and when we get into our actual review on the podcast, we'll talk about it. There is such a musicality to the way that he writes these books, and I think that that's obviously very intentional because of Mateo's character, but also I think it's just kind of part of Daniel, too. So I hope you guys will check it out. I hope that you've read the book. If not, you still got plenty of time before our episode, and I think it's, you know, I think it's a solid conclusion to this duology and definitely made me want more in that world. Even if it's not about Mateo and Chela, like, I would just like to explore a little bit more of that world, specifically one character in particular, but we'll get to that later. And Reed Riordan also posted an interview with Daniel, and they had some really nice questions in there, some kind of deep philosophical ones, and also about the writing process, and, like, they were, like, asking about the difference in writing the two books, and he was like, this first book, I outlined it to death. Like, every single thing was outlined. The second book, no idea what was going to happen. Started writing it, no idea how it was going to end. And I was like, sometimes that's just the way that it is. You can't help it. But it's really interesting to see how people's, I mean, as a writer, to see how people's processes change book to book and project to project. So, very cool for him. I also wanted to remind everybody that The Enchanted Hacienda by J.C. Cervantes is also out. That also came out on May 16th. This is not a Rick Riordan Presents book. It is an adult romance. And I posted a review of that as well. It was very good. If you like Encanto, you will like this book. It's got a lot of similar, like, themes, and it has a lot of similar vibes, but also love and romance, and it's very nice. But it is an adult novel.
I was going to say, on the spicy scale, are we talking, like, maybe one pepper, two peppers?
Out of four or five.
Four or five, whatever. We can say five.
I would say, like, two, probably. Okay. It's got some explicit things, but it's a little more fade to black than, like,
and it's more, like, flowery than it is, like, descriptive.
Yeah. She definitely, like, says what things that happen, but the book is, like, a lot more plot than it is, like, the spice element. Okay.
Just in case people were curious, because I know when you're talking about romance, people immediately go to, like, one end of either spectrum.
Yeah.
And there is a, it's a gradual spectrum. There's books that fit all along the whole thing, so. Yeah, somewhere in the, there's a few, you know, spicy, sexy scenes, but not, like, doesn't, like, take it over. Good to know.
I also wanted to mention, too, real quick, that Always Isn't Forever comes out on June 6th. So, actually, that's the same day as Gracie's book, The Last Fallen Realm, but J.C. Cervantes, that's a YA romance.
Ah, okay.
That she's very excited about, and I interviewed her as well, which was probably one of the best interviews that I've ever done. She was incredible and so kind and thoughtful, and I have the whole interview posted on Subjectify Media. I will link to it. And she talks a lot about the process of writing, about The Enchanted Hacienda. She mentions always isn't forever as well. And some of the emotional stuff going into that. And, like, I just really like how she approaches her writing a lot. But the more important part is that she also talks about writing for Rick Riordan Presents and, you know, how great Rick is and that whole team and everything, which is, you know, she had so many incredible things to say about Stephanie Lurie as well. And aww. I was like, I get it. Like, everything we've ever heard about her is just incredible, and she is so good at her job and so good about, like, helping these authors cultivate the stories that they're trying to get out there. So very, very lucky that Rick has Stephanie and that Rick Riordan Presents has Stephanie.
Mm-hmm.
She talked about which Rick Riordan Presents world she'd live in. So you have to go read the interview to find out. I'm going to tease you with that one.
Mm.
But she also said that she might have a new project for Disney coming up. She couldn't talk about it yet. We don't know if it's Rick Riordan Presents.
Which is fair.
I feel like there was a vibe that maybe it was, but I don't quote me on that. You can read the exact context in the interview. But I was really excited about that. And even if it's not for Rick Riordan Presents, just being able to write a Disney book, like, it could be, you know, a fairy tale book or some sort of adaptation book or something.
Heck yeah. And if it's, like, a new series that's just being done under the Disney Books umbrella, mm-hmm. that's awesome. That put, you know, it, all of the authors in RRP are on equal footing with Rick. But to have a series not in RRP, but just with Disney Books kind of feels like you're stepping out on your own.
Yeah.
Like, it's still Disney, but it's like, you know, you're in that, you've reached the, I'm not in the imprint, I'm in the big world kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which, it's not really bigger. It's all the same publishing world, yeah. but it just feels different.
It is. I mean, I think so that that's cool. Disney definitely, you know, Disney is up there for a reason, and I think, yeah, regardless of what she ends up writing, I think it's going to be great. We talked a lot about mythology, too, and how important that is to her and the other, like, stories that she would really like to explore. So, you know, even if it's not Rick Riordan Presents, maybe it's a brand new series not related to her other ones in RRP, or maybe it's something else entirely that maybe RRP didn't have room for or something like that. We'll just have to see, but I'm really excited about that. She also talked, if you've read the Stormrunner series and the Lords of Night series, which, you know, unfortunately we haven't, we will get there. I'm even more excited to read them. She talked a lot about Apuch, which was the god of death. I think you got him as, like,
I think so.
Yeah.
It sounds familiar.
She talked a lot about how important that character was for him, and the last book, and then teased a little bit of The Dawn of the Jaguar.
Mm.
So if that's your jam, go check it out. I'll link to it. Like I mentioned, The Last Fallen Realm by Gracie Kim, which is the final Gifted Clans book, comes out on June 6th. That is very soon. That is like a week away from when we're recording.
And I already have my audiobook on hold at the library for this. I'm very excited.
Yeah.
I'm first in line. I didn't think I would be, but I put my hold in, and yeah. it said I was first, and I got very excited.
Nice.
I'm never first.
I'm really excited about this one because we really enjoyed The Last Fallen Star and the world that Gracie has built and all of the food and all of the creatures. I've read The Last Fallen Moon. You are currently working your way through it, and we will be talking about that soon. And so I think by the end of that book, some stuff happens, and you're really like, where is this going to go? So I'm very excited about The Last Fallen Realm.
Yeah.
So that is June 6th. Pre-order if you can. Request it from your library if you can't. I know that Gracie would really, really appreciate that. And Reed Riordan has been doing some promo for this book as well. They have two spotlights up on the website. One is for Arium, which is a sort of like bird woman creature. And the other one is Taggy, who is a very adorable looking little caterpillar worm thing. And I am, apparently, the Waker Pillar is what it's called.
Oh.
But
I haven't reached that part yet.
Yeah, I don't know what this is exactly, and I'm not going to read it because this will be spoilers for The Last Fallen Realm, and I have not had a chance to dive into that yet. But they are there if you want to get a sneak peek. I guess it was only The Sun and the Star where I was like, I need to read everything that they put out on this book. And all the other books, I'm like, no, don't spoil me. Which you'd think it would be the opposite, but apparently I hold the other books a lot, like, closer.
Books, I don't want to know people's spoilers. Like, if people get advanced copies, I don't want them telling you what happens. But as long as the author has okayed it to go out as an excerpt, I expect that it's not going to ruin anything. So yeah. I'm usually pretty much on board to read excerpts. I don't necessarily run and read them all. But, you know, as long as they're out there, it's acceptable in my brain.
Yeah.
It's very weird place, maybe.
I think it's actually, like, I mean, I totally agree with you on most things. Specifically with The Sun and the Star, I think I literally could not control myself. Like, I had to know everything that I possibly could. Yeah. So, there's that.
Yeah.
So, Gracie does live in New Zealand, and I know she is doing a, like, in-person book tour, I'm pretty sure. But there are two virtual events. And I believe they are both free to attend. You know, if you don't buy a book, like, you can just attend for free. June 4th at 3 p.m. Eastern will be the Books of Wonder event, who they always put on a great event. That one specifically, I think there's like five or six different authors who are going to be joining that event. And then June 6th, so the day the book comes out, at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, which is 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Mysterious Galaxy is also putting on an event. And I think that's just Gracie and one other author kind of like in conversation. I will be attending that one. I've already registered for it because I won't be able to see Gracie in person at any of her other stops. So, which, now that I'm saying that, I don't know for sure. So, I was just looking at her website, and I'm not entirely sure she is doing an in-person tour.
Okay.
Because she did one for The Last Fallen Moon and The Last Fallen Star, but I am not seeing anything on her website. So if that is wrong, please correct me, and I will put something up on Twitter about it, but I haven't been able to find anything, at least on her website. You would think that would be updated, but at the very least, she is doing two different virtual events, which is very excited. I'll be at the one on June 6th, and I'll try to tweet something out about it and then tell you guys, if you weren't able to attend on the next episode, what happened there. So yes, we are very excited for The Last Fallen Realm and hope you guys are too. So reorder it. Okay, Reed Riordan also posted two other articles in the last 2 weeks. One is called Nyx's Guide to Getting a Good Night's Sleep. This is more of like a funny article where she's like, don't care about anybody, be in complete darkness, like, sell your soul, you know, stuff like that. It's kind of funny, but it doesn't really offer like any information or anything like that. And then they also posted new and upcoming AAPI titles from Rick Riordan Presents, which, of course, the month of May, now that we are in June 1st, the month of May was Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. They did post this on May 19th, so it's not like they did it right at the end of the month.
We're just a little behind.
Yeah, but they talked about The Last Fallen Realm, Fox Snare, The Spirit Glass, Winston Chu versus the Whimsies, Fury of the Dragon Goddess, and A Drop of Venom. So they've really got a good lineup now between all of those authors, and there are more in those series and stuff, like, you know, Fox Snare is book 3 from Yunha Lee, Fury of the Dragon Goddess is book 2, and like Winston Chu, there will be more in that series. So,
and we all know Roshni has an entire 5-book series.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, that is all super great, and so I hope that you were able to read at least one of those books during the month of May, and if you didn't, hey, you can do it now. Nobody says you can't.
Just because AAPI month is over doesn't mean that we do not celebrate it all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And the last major bit of news, which is actually pretty exciting, is Variety reported that Walker Scobell, who of course is going to be Percy Jackson, joined Blood Knot, starring Cameron and Michael Douglas, plus David Morse and Michael Stahl David. That's kind of funny. David. directed by Roberto Snyder. This film is based on Bob Rich's novel, Looking Through Water. It follows a father who, in an attempt to reconnect with his estranged son, invites him to Belize to compete in a father-son fishing competition. We don't know who Walker is playing, but I wonder if it's going to be like a younger version of Cameron Douglas. That would make sense to me.
Yeah.
So, like, Cameron and Michael Douglas are real-life father and son.
Right.
And I assume that it's going to be, like, them going on the fishing trip and then, like, flashbacks maybe to Walker, which, go Walker, mm-hmm. being in a movie with Michael Douglas, you know, no slouch there, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really cool that he's getting more pretty big roles. I mean, we don't know how big of a role in that movie will be, but the production will probably be a pretty big production, and we already know he can stand on his own against some of the greats, so yeah. I'm not worried at all about this.
Not at all.
You know, this is just also a good time to remind you guys that the writer's strike is still on, and it is still affecting lots of TV shows and movies across the board, and
including Deadpool. Ryan Reynolds isn't allowed. Ryan Reynolds is currently filming Deadpool 3, and he is not allowed to improvise.
Oh my god!
Because improvising is writing. He's not allowed to improvise on the set of Deadpool 3 right now. That's been going across the Twitter sphere for the last couple of days. Like, I wonder how Ryan is dealing with this. And it's like, it's not funny because it is funny. It's hilarious. But it's also, like, a real concern when you're filming during a strike like this. They can't rewrite anything. Mm-hmm. And so it makes it very hard when you're a character like Deadpool where playing around with it is part of your thing. So, it's interesting.
I wonder if Walker's going to get a cameo in that movie.
It would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. I would not necessarily bet money that it would happen. Maybe a little bit of money. But, like, it's probable. Not probable. It's possible.
Yes.
I think it's possible. So,
yeah.
Fingers crossed for Walker because he would love that.
And I know there's been a lot of talk about the other associations and agencies, like the WGA is the Writers Guild, but the Directors Guild and the Screen Actors Guild have been in talks of their own about, because I know the Screen Actors Guild is kind of looking to update their contract, whatever. And so they're also in a possible striking situation coming up here, too. So there's just a lot going on right now in the entertainment world and trying to handle some of the advancements and things that have gone on and making sure everybody's fairly compensated. So that's, you know, it's once it gets figured out, we'll be able to get things back on track. But hopefully it will be sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And I believe that's never happened before, like all three striking at once.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I don't think they've ever had two strike at once.
Really?
But I don't know that for sure. Do not quote me. I am not a historian. But, like, the Screen Actors Guild and the Writers Guild are usually very closely related because so many writers, especially comedians, are actors and writers, that they're very closely linked.
Yeah.
So it definitely makes sense that the Screen Actors Guild is also looking at their contracts and looking into renegotiating things. So.
Yeah. So, you know, if anything changes, we will keep you up to date on that. And Becky has been pretty good about tweeting about it and kind of saying stuff about it, too. So make sure you keep an eye on her Twitter as well. Also, be nice to Becky. I'm just...
Always.
I mean, I don't think any of our listeners are mean to Becky.
No, I don't think so.
But she's had to talk about, you know, a few times, like, I might have to close my comments because people are just being kind of rude. And she really is trying to cultivate, like, a safe space and an open space where she can talk to us about behind-the-scenes stuff that doesn't always happen, especially with Rick off social media.
Yeah.
She is a direct line to the show and to Rick. So,
and if you have questions, feel free to ask her. Just, you know, make sure you're asking it in a respectful way. She answers a lot of questions.
She does.
Is very, very easy to reach on Twitter especially. So, yeah, just be kind.
Yes, always. Okay, our last bit of business is kind of a big conversation. One that we wanted to have on the podcast because a lot of people feel very strongly about this topic.
On both sides.
On both sides. And I'm just going to read... So basically, there was a Goodreads question about this, and Rick wrote a very lengthy response to it that I think both Kristen and I connected very much to his answer. So I'm just going to do that, and then we'll have a little discussion afterwards. So Night Owl on Goodreads said, I was just curious about your personal stance on fan art depictions of Annabeth. Some fans believe that Annabeth should only be drawn as a black girl from now on, and that people who continue to draw Whitabeth, I did not know they called it Whitabeth.
Me neither.
Kind of a good name, though. Are contributing to racist responses about Leah's casting. What are your thoughts on this? Rick says, look, my opinion is not the ultimate authority on this, and people are allowed to have different feelings about fan art representation. Actually, I think we should take this bit by bit, because
sure.
I just want to say, like, I like that he says this, because not every author is that, like, giving to their fan base, where, like, if they say something goes, that's how it goes. There are plenty of authors out there. I think Anne Rice was one of the biggest ones who hated fan fiction, didn't want any fan fiction, and just didn't want that story to exist outside of their canon that they wrote. And Rick has never been that way. Even if he doesn't read it, he understands why people write that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always really respected him for that. And I just like that he's like... And he says this again at the end a little bit, like, that just he's not the ultimate authority. And I appreciate that.
Yeah.
He goes on, I get the concern. Personally, one of the things I love about fans making the Percy Jackson world their own is that they can explore many different representations of the characters. Annabeth, Percy, and the rest have always appealed to many kinds of people. Book Annabeth was originally conceived of as white. That is true. There have been a lot of discussions in the fandom about the fact that it's not strictly clear in the book whether Annabeth
is white. Tan and blonde, but never is said to be Caucasian or white.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think for him to, like... Unfortunately, I think for him saying that, the people who are on the wrong side of the argument, and what I mean by that is, like, for the wrong reasons, for the racist reasons, are going to pull from this.
Yeah.
And pull it out of context, because he goes on to say a lot more things.
Oh, yeah. But no, I hear you.
Yeah. I mean, I understand why he said it like that, and I'm not criticizing that decision at all, but I do think some people are going to pull it out of context. He continues, Leah Jeffries is an incredible Annabeth. In my opinion, the absolute epitome of Annabeth's character. And she is black. The many Lightning Thief musical productions that we've seen staged around the U.S. and beyond have cast actors of all races and genders and body types playing Percy, Annabeth, and Grover. I love that. Pausing here again, because we saw the Lightning Thief musical, and the guy who played Grover was not white.
Mm-mm.
I don't remember exactly what his, like, ethnicity or nationality was.
Yeah, no, I don't really remember either.
He was incredible.
Yeah. And, like, and he was also a slightly, like, bigger guy.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't, you know, really, like, Hollywood thin kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, he was
or
a little
swole.
But he did a great job. He was a little swole. But, like, yeah, he did a really great job.
Yeah.
And, like, it was, Broadway doesn't always do very well with casting different, like, body types.
Yeah.
And so it was really encouraging and exciting to see somebody as Grover that looked a little different from what everybody else kind of envisions.
And the thing is, like, he was Grover. Like,
yeah.
His
oh, yeah.
personality, the way that he portrayed Grover was Grover. It didn't matter what he looked like. And I think that that's sort of what Rick is saying here. So, continuing, the whole point of Percy Jackson is that anyone can be a hero, and heroes can look like anyone in the world. It's not what you look like that makes you Annabeth or Percy. It's what you do when you face a critical moment, whether or not you step up, and whether you have the character of a hero. Because of that, I don't feel like we should be laying down a law that Annabeth fan art must look one way only, and every other type is wrong. I've seen some incredible fan art of Desi Percy Jackson, Latino Percy Jackson, Black Percy Jackson, and on and on. Why not? It's wonderful that all kinds of kids can imagine themselves as Percy, whether or not it is a canon description in the books, or whether it matches the casting on screen. As for Annabeth, absolutely. Leah deserves respect as Annabeth. She is Annabeth in the TV show, chosen by me, and I am confident that once the show is out, she is how most people will imagine Annabeth from then on. I don't think drawing Annabeth fan art in different ways is automatically or inherently disrespectful of her in the role of Annabeth, however. Could it become a problem or be done with problematic intent? Sure, in which case it's wrong, but most of what I have seen is just people imagining, headcanoning, mourning Annabeth in different ways for their own enjoyment and artistic expression, often based on how they imagined her while they read the books. As long as it's not done with any negative intention, I don't have a problem with that. And I want to pause here because this is really
the heart of the issue.
It is. It's really the heart of the issue. I completely agree with this. I think that there are a lot of fan artists who have, at this point, been drawing Percy, Annabeth, and Grover for 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
And what they had in their heads was a white Annabeth, for example. That is as much their Annabeth, their version of Annabeth, as it is Rick's intent with the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I can completely understand them wanting to continue to draw Annabeth in that way. I think the issue comes with, one, thinking that's the only version, that Leah's Annabeth is not Annabeth because it's not book Annabeth. That's right. Wrong. That's just plain wrong. And I think there is a lot of racist intent behind that, and that is a huge problem. Because like Rick said, he chose Leah as Annabeth.
Right. I think if the TV production was being done outside of Rick's influence,
mm-hmm.
and they had casted someone who looked entirely different than Percy, per se, you know, like, they casted, you know, someone of entirely different ethnic descent or whatever, I feel like it would feel different, like, if it wasn't, Rick chose Leah. Like, he was, had a hand in seeing her audition, said, that is my Annabeth, that is Annabeth Chase. It's different when he is, you know, approving of a change made to his book.
Mm-hmm.
It just, it hits different. Like, it's not, I don't know how to word this either. Like, it's, I know people who see any changes made to a book character as going against the story, and why would you change things? Like, it was perfect as it was. And, like, we can have book Annabeth. We can have the white girl with sandy blonde hair and, you know, is constantly tan and whatever. We can have her and still also love Leah as Annabeth and have her be our Annabeth from here on out. Like, mm-hmm. you can have both. We don't have to choose. And I think right. that's more or less what Rick's getting at here. Like, just because people who've been drawing Annabeth for years are still selling and promoting their white Annabeth art doesn't mean that they don't think Leah's going to be great or that Leah should be drawn now. Like, that doesn't change anything. If people want to draw black Annabeth, absolutely. It's like, there's a whole new world because we actually have a person who's going to be playing black Annabeth that now we can see her in that specific body in that form mm-hmm. and, like, use that in art from here on out. So, like, yeah, it's, there's a lot of people, I think, who are taking things and kind of twisting them to meet their own objective. And it's really sad because Rick has been so open and honest and, you know, has included us in all of this. And it just, yeah, it's really unfortunate that people are kind of taking the opportunity to make, you know, people who are not doing anything in any sort of ill-conceived way, and they're mm-hmm. twisting their actions.
I think the problem there, too, is that there are absolutely some people who are only drawing white Annabeth because they are racist.
Yes, absolutely.
Because they do not think that Leah will be Annabeth. When Rick literally just said, what makes Annabeth Annabeth is her personality, the way right. that she steps up to her, up to the plate, her intelligence, all of that. It really has nothing to do with her looks. But at the same time, it is important to highlight representation and differences in people. And I think that the people who are only drawing white Annabeth because they believe that's the only one that is the real one, that was air quotes, that you couldn't yes. see, I think that they have to reflect very deeply on why they are doing that. I think if there is no ill intent there, I think that we both agree that it's perfectly fine to continue to draw white Annabeth. With one note saying, ask yourself why you're not drawing black Annabeth. Ask yourself why you're not drawing Leah. Is it because you don't know how to draw different skin tones? If that's the case, you should learn. It's important to expand your art, and it's important for, even if you are white, to learn how to draw other skin tones and add to the representation with your own privilege and your own talent in whatever way you can. And if you're scared for some other reason, just think about it for a while and challenge yourself to draw Black Annabeth with different hairstyles and different poses. It's like anything else, just like practicing and trying to get better with your art. I think that's really, really important.
Agreed.
So the last bit of this says, the big reason I prefer books to TV or movies is that books allow space for your imagination to create the way you see the characters. If I wanted to show you a picture that said, this is exactly the way Annabeth looks and she cannot look like anything else, I wouldn't write novels. I'd have to be a visual artist, and I'm a terrible visual artist. Again, this is all just my two cents. The only thing I can say for sure is that I do not have all the answers, and I am always learning. And I think that's the last thing that I really want to address about this, is that I think we've talked about this before. Both Kristen and I are white.
Yes.
And we are also always learning, and I am very, very, very sympathetic to the people of color who have struggled with the racism that Leah has seen due to her casting and the racism that has existed in their own lives. And I understand the pushback against the white Annabeth and people continuing to draw white Annabeth. I get it. And this is not a simple black and white conversation. There's a lot more of a gray area here. And I'm really, like, I see the dangers in continuing to promote a white Annabeth over a black Annabeth.
Right.
But I think you said it when you were like, they can both exist.
Yeah.
And as long as there's no ill intent there, and as long as you as an artist are willing to challenge yourself and expand, I think that we can be happy with both.
Yeah, absolutely. And not just those. As Rick said, like, he's seen Desi Percy Jackson,
yeah,
and he's seen, you know, like, an Asian American, you know, kind of interpretation of Percy or whatever. Like, you feel free to use your imagination with these characters, I think is more or less what Rick's saying. You know, he wrote them initially white. More or less, I think, because that was his life experience.
It's his default.
And he just left it there.
Yeah.
As he's gone on, he's learned a lot about the world, and his characters reflect that in the later books. And you get a much more diverse group of kids representing demigods. And so I don't think just because the first series was earlier in Rick's life and he wasn't ready to write characters of different nationalities and whatever, I think that doesn't mean that those characters are locked in as that forever. And we definitely know that because Leah and, not just Leah, but also
yeah,
the other kids in the cast.
Yeah, Arian.
Arian, thank you. I'm drawing blank on all their names. I was like, what's his name? Who's Grover? Yeah, Arian and even the girl playing Clarice. Dior is also of a different, you know, Clarice was definitely drawn originally, or she was definitely conceived as a white character, but like, there's no reason why Dior is not going to be an amazing Clarice.
I know.
And I'm very much looking forward to seeing
yeah,
that. So, yeah, I think that's more or less the thing to take away here. If you're, you know, if you're only drawing white Annabeth because you don't want to include all of these other people, that's what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the fact that you have art that has white Annabeth. It's if you're doing it specifically because you can't envision her in another way, it might be time for some self-reflection.
Yeah. I think intent is very important there, but it's also not just the people who have good intentions. The conversation lately has been talking about being not just not racist, but anti-racist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very much tied into this conversation where it's not just about you don't have any ill intent drawing white Annabeth, but really thinking about why you haven't drawn black Annabeth and really reflecting on that. And I think that's an important part of the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there you go. That is the news and updates for today. A little heavy on
yeah,
the back end.
A little
there,
bit there. But thank you, Rick, for directly addressing it, because I think it does help people to kind of see what he thinks on the situation and lets people make, you know, an informed choice and decision
right,
about what artists they support and all of that. So
yeah, I completely agree with that. And it's just, it's a very good conversation to have. But now we are getting into our chapter reviews for this week. I feel like it's been 800 years since we talked about the King Chronicles, but I really don't think it has been.
No, it really hasn't been. I also felt similarly. When I picked up my e-reader and looked at the chapter we were reading, I was like, oh, we left them there, didn't we? Yeah. Okay, they were, you know.
They were getting chased.
Yeah, and Bass had just, like, done the thing with the wrecking ball.
The wrecking ball, yeah. And stolen the car.
Right, and we were just dealing with the carriers that we had just figured out what they were. So, yeah, we are now going to talk about the Kane Chronicles, The Red Pyramid, Chapter 10, entitled Bast Goes Green. So, as far as recaps go, I mean, this chapter is pretty succinct because it's another one of those travel chapters, and basically, Bast gets them to the obelisk, and then Sadie can't open the obelisk, so they retreat.
Yeah.
I mean,
they
ultimately
fight somebody along the way.
Right. And then they fight folks.
Yeah.
It's this chapter does not have a ton going on, but there are a few things noteworthy, so we'll get into that now as we dive deep. So, this chapter starts with Bast driving into New York City toward the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is the Met, right?
Yes.
Crazy, okay.
Yeah.
I'm not a New Yorker. I don't know. So, yeah, they're driving toward the Met, and as they're going, the carriers are following them, and Bast must put out a feeler? I don't know. She puts out a signal. The cat signal?
Yeah.
That just came to me. I'm a genius. And an insane number of cats descend from the surrounding buildings and, the you know, come out of the gutters and whatever, and they descend on the carriers. They weigh the box down. They attack them. They even cause two cars to crash, which blocks the street, which makes it harder for the carriers to follow, basically delaying them so that Bast can continue to get the kids out of danger.
Yeah. Can I just say that if I had the power to call cats like that, I would sleep in a kitty pile, like, all the time. Can you imagine just, like, 20 cats purring on top of
like,
you?
Like, the minute you start to feel the slightest bit sad, you're just like, come to me. And they just, like, cuddle you and they purr, like, all the purring. It would be so nice.
How could you be sad after that?
Right? Purrs are healing. There's science on
that. There is science.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the diversion, yeah, allows Bast to race Carter and Sadie to the obelisk behind the Met, which is their goal, because I remember in the previous chapter, the obelisk is supposed to function as, like, a transportation thing. It's like a gateway kind of
thing. Yeah, to the Duat.
Yeah.
I think that's, like, the whole thing.
Yeah, so that's why they're headed there.
And I think the obelisk, like, shape in particular is, like, really important. It's, like, magical.
Yeah.
I also just have to point out that, like, this obelisk is in Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
The entrance to the underworld is, like, right there.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't even know it.
Right.
And I'm just like, oh. They obviously take place, these stories, most of the time in different parts of New York City. But this is, like, an area where it overlaps. And I just, that makes me so excited.
It's like, where in the timeline does the Kane Chronicles fall? Like, are Percy and Grover, like, on the other side of those trees, talking about, you know, looking at Orpheus's gate and, you know, figuring that out? Like, what is happening right
now?
What
is happening right
now? Yeah. It's fun to think about. It really is. Like, the Empire State Building's right there! Yeah, no, it's good fun. Okay, so Bast tells Sadie to focus her magic on the obelisk and to focus particularly on opening a portal to the Duat. And, of course, Sadie is like, I don't know how to do any of this. Why don't you do it? You're a god. And Bast is like, I don't do portals. Like, it's not my forte. I do other things.
I do combat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the fighting thing that you saw me do before. Yeah, that was me.
I also loved how Bast was like, yeah, fear and panic will, like, totally kill a spell. And it's like, we're getting chased right now.
Well, she says that. And then she says, we really need to get out of here before Set does da-da-da. And I'm like, that's really going to help with the fear and panic there, Bast. Come on now. Like, help a girl out.
She is a cat. I don't think she, like, really gets, you know, the human emotion thing.
Definitely not. So, yeah, Sadie has some trouble, but she's trying. And as she's attempting to open this portal, the carriers catch up and the cats kind of give Bast notes and, like, let her know that they're almost here. Like, you might want to, you know, do your thing. It's here that we learn, special note, that linen is good for magicians because it's not an animal product. Apparently, animal products like leather or wool can carry residual life auras, which can interfere with spells, which is why when Carter was choosing clothes in the house, they were all white linen.
Right.
It makes so much more sense.
Yeah.
So they tend to stick with, like, plant fibers, which It's good
I
to know.
That's so interesting, like, to think about residual life auras. I mean, also really sad because, yeah. like, I mean, not that we wear, you know, a ton of animal products these days. A lot of things are, like, made out of pleather cotton, and stuff like yeah. that. Yeah. But, like, still, that's, I mean, that kind of bums me out a little bit. That, yeah. like, they're still sticking around you when you're in your wool coat.
It also makes sense. I mean, like, I actually really like this explanation because it clarifies why they have a focus on certain cloth and whatever.
Right.
And it doesn't have really anything to do with, like, linen being an old cloth or, like, something they made back then, so they just stuck with it. No, there's an actual, like, literal reason why yeah. it's better. Yeah, love that. There's also a specific, like, as we're kind of going through this, Bast and Carter have a little conversation, and he's basically saying, like, why can't we, like, get the good gods to come and fight these bad gods that are chasing us? Like, why aren't more of you showing up to help? What's going on? And Bast has a quote that I think I picked as my favorite quote. Yeah, I did. Which I can talk about it again then because I like it so much. But Bast says, evil and good may not be the best way to think of it, Carter. As a magician, you must think about chaos and order.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a very interesting way.
Objectively the best quote in this chapter.
I think so too, yeah. yeah. It's an interesting way to think about things. We're so used to in books there being a good side and a bad side, and the good side is trying to stop the bad side, and the bad side is trying to do the evil thing. And, like, I like that here we're already looking at it and saying, it's not necessarily good and evil, it's this person wants order and this person wants chaos, and those things, like good and evil, are constantly at odds.
Right.
And so it's not necessarily that these people are evil, they just have a different thought about how things mm-hmm. should be.
I really, really love this concept, too, because we've heard before in stories, you know, the villain is the hero of their own tale. And I think that makes a better villain because they think they're good. They think they're right. They think they're righteous.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes for a more complicated, interesting character. I also like this because there's a lot less morality built into it. It's not right and wrong. It's just a balance. And, you know, talking about Nemesis recently, Nemesis isn't good or bad. She's just about balance. And sometimes that causes her to do good things. Sometimes it causes her to do bad things. And I like it because it feels so much more neutral. And I keep thinking about, for example, Hermes, who's a trickster god, has done plenty of good and bad things.
Mm-hmm.
Loki, probably the perfect example, especially if you think about the Loki from the Marvel movies. He did a lot of bad things early on. He did a lot of good things later on. But he, at his core, was always that, like, chaotic neutral. Chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you to not be so rigid in what is right and wrong and what is good and evil. And I think it makes it so much more interesting because of that.
I think if you kind of view Hades in the same way, Hades is actually turns into a very different feel of a character.
Right.
He's all about order.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're trying to, like, you know, if you're thinking chaos is bad, like, you would automatically kind of assume that people who want order are good. And in that case, Hades would be one of the most good Olympian gods there is.
Right.
Because all he wants is order and for things to go the way they're supposed to go, and he has a job and he's doing his job. Like, you'd all. But when you think about the Greek gods, he almost always gets classified with the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not necessarily. He's just the god of the underworld.
Yeah. That's a concept that, once I realized that, has always been fascinating to me, because the Greeks did not view Hades as a bad guy. They were scared of him because they're scared of death. They didn't
yeah.
want to die. But ultimately, like we did in our deep dive on Hades, like, you're right, he cares a lot about order. He cares a lot about his job. And his job deals in death. So, like, he might get a bad reputation because of that. But what he does is neither good nor evil. It just is. It exists. It's a necessary part of the universe.
If you want to humanize the whole thing, it's kind of like a mortician. People are weirded out and scared
right.
by morticians who are literally just doing a job that must be done.
Mm-hmm.
They're taking care of the dead. They're helping families to grieve. They're setting up, you know, giving opportunities to say goodbye to loved ones. And someone someone has to do that job, and people still feel like, you know, morticians who choose to spend their life taking care of the dead are weird. And it's not necessarily weird, it's just a job. So, just another little thing.
Yeah, it was such a good quote, and I think it came at the perfect time. And I think this early on in the story, I really want to hold on to this concept and then see how things play out by the end of the trilogy.
Yeah. And right after this quote, Carter continues to ask Bast, what about the other gods Dad released? Aren't they good guys? Isis, Osiris, Horus, Nephthys, where are they? And Bast looks at him and just says, that's a good question.
Yeah.
And she kind of says it in a way that's like, where are they, Carter? Like, I don't...
Like, he should know.
Yeah. Like, I don't know what that means yet, but I have a feeling that Carter has some sort of link or knows something about his dad that's going to help them find where these other gods currently are being held, or where they're located, or where they fled to when all of this went down. I don't know. But it's good to think about, like, Isis, Osiris, Horus, Nephthys, they clearly are not chaos gods. They seem to be the kind that are looking for order rather than chaos. So they would be probably, hopefully, positive to run across, and maybe we will. We don't know. But yeah, I thought definitely worth noting.
But like the Greek gods, even Poseidon, who is ultimately pretty good for Percy, has caused some problems in the past. So it's really hard to assign morality to a divine being like that, who does not see it in the humanistic terms that we would.
I mean, we all have seen the Hercules Disney movie or whatever, and you think of Zeus as the happy god figure, and he is not.
He is not.
So, you know, it's just, it's good to keep your mind open and think about things in a different way, and that's definitely worth doing with the Egyptian gods. Okay. Let's keep right on moving. In addition to the carriers, one of the cats tells Bast that something more powerful is coming from the east. The carriers, I think, are coming from the west. So it's like, oh, great, there's something else on its way. Fabulous. Since Sadie still is having trouble opening a portal, Bast gets ready to fight. And she says that combat magic is one of her specialties. And they were like, Carter, I think, says, like, oh, like we saw back there. She goes, oh, no. That was just combat.
Yeah.
We're going to see combat magic in a second. Yeah. And pretty soon, she is this... Her body still exists, the best we've been seeing, but she has this giant green aura that has formed an energy bubble around her in the shape of her ancient form, a 20-foot-tall woman with the head of a cat, and her person is like floating in it, so she's controlling it.
Yeah,
it's like a kaiju.
I was like a
or not Jaeger? A kaiju. Like a Jaeger.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Like that's exactly what I was envisioning, but instead it was like kind of see through. It's like a transparent one.
Yeah,
but I was thinking the exact same thing.
So if you've ever seen Pacific Rim, you kind of have a visual.
And if you haven't, go watch it.
It's
brilliant
good fun.
Movie.
It's good fun. Yeah, but it's like a person inside a giant robot suit, but hers is her aura. It's
right.
Even better.
Yeah, and it's green, so I loved it.
No mechanicals to fail when you're using an aura.
And apparently Jaeger. That aura is, like, pretty solid. Like, they tried to, like, hurt her, and they couldn't.
Yeah, and, like, Carter talks about the big foot, like, stomping, and things just, you know, you could feel the impact of
right.
it. So it might look, like, it's not solid, but it is. It is very much a solid green form, even if it looks like floating bubble.
Yeah.
So Bast makes pretty quick work of the carriers, but as she's like, you know, taking them down or whatever, they do start to reform, and that's when Carter gets in on helping her, and they chop them up into tiny pieces. Which is really gross, but, you know, you gotta do what you gotta do.
I'm glad that Carter kind of got to do, the easy part, that she took him down, and then he was just like, chop, 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 chop.
He's got his sword, and he's just sitting there hacking away while she's going after the next one. Yeah, it was pretty funny. Meanwhile, Sadie is yelling at the obelisk now, just saying, come on, and it's not doing anything.
Yeah.
So it's at that moment that this powerful being from the east arrives, and we find out that it is Serket.
That sounds right to me.
That's
based on nothing, but
yeah, right. Just me looking at context clues and letters. Serket, the scorpion goddess, sends a horde of thousands of scorpions down on our heroes.
Yeah.
And then we hear about Carter and his aversion to all things scorpion.
Aversion is a good word, yeah. Also, I would like to point out that I was just in, like, Utah, Nevada, and Arizona, all of which have scorpions. The Airbnb we were staying at had scorpions. I did not see any. I didn't see any. But it's like, if you leave your shoes out on the patio, you have to knock them out to make sure you're not sticking your foot in where a scorpion's
going
to be.
Spiders are bad enough. I can't do scorpions. Yeah. I can't.
And, like, I can't. Some of them are very difficult to see. You need, like, a black light to be able to see them. I should not be telling you this. She has a horrified look on her face right now.
Why would anyone live in these places?
Who knows? But it is important to stay safe from scorpions.
Yeah, for sure. Cirquette is described as being a woman with brown robes and gold jewelry, long black hair cut ancient Egyptian style, which I'm assuming is like Cleopatra style?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe like with bangs or something. I must have missed that it was long black hair because I thought it was like in a bob, which is how I usually picture Cleopatra. Yeah. I don't know if that's real.
But, I don't either. Yeah. But I thought it was funny that the only descriptor for her hair was long black cut ancient Egyptian style.
Yeah.
Like, what is that? I don't know what that
Can
is.
I go to my hairstylist and be like,
ancient Egyptian stuff, please? Yeah. Yeah. I'm assuming it's kind of like the Cleopatra cut, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. And a live supersized scorpion is sitting on her head, kind of acting as a crown.
Yeah.
Carter thinks it's a crown at first, and then he realizes it's a lie.
Yeah. Which is a little badass. I mean, if you're going to be, like, the goddess of, like, that kind of stuff, like, have a scorpion crown. That's awesome. As a Scorpio myself, I appreciate the visual. I did a tiny, tiny, tiny deep dive into her because I just wanted to know a little bit more about her without, like, diving into her history or anything.
I appreciate this.
She is both the goddess of venomous creatures and the goddess of healing venomous stings and bites.
Mm.
So, again, with the balance, the duality, she's neither good nor evil. It just, she's both, kind of, at the same time. Her name can either mean she who tightens the throat or she who causes the throat to breathe. So, again, same concept.
Mm.
Really love the duality. And apparently, she stings the unrighteous. That's kind of like her whole shtick.
Which, if she is currently working with Set, would mean that she kind of falls on the chaos side of things. So she would see those that want order as being more unrighteous, which
right.
is why she's attacking.
It is kind
Carter
of a matter
and right now.
Of perception.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Perspective.
Yeah. But yeah, very interesting. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Just so we have some actual information,
yeah.
not just what we got in Red Pyramid. It's nice
yeah.
to have some real history.
Hopefully we'll be able to talk about her more. I don't think we can talk to her.
I don't know if
Probably.
I want to.
Yeah, that's true.
She can keep her giant scorpion crown
away
from
over
me.
There.
Yeah.
But hopefully we can do like an actual deep dive on her at some point.
I think that would be good. It'd be a lot of fun, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so the last thing here, Cirquette is coming toward them and you can see this mass of scorpions headed their way. Bast is like, okay, Sadie's not getting this done. We're not going to get a portal open in time. She sends Sadie and Carter into the Met, tells them to find the temple and that hopefully it will protect them, and she's going to stay here and fight. And she does not look really confident
yeah.
that things are going to go her way. I mean, she's a, you know, pretty badass, so she's going to do her best, but she clearly doesn't know how this is going to end, and she wants them to at least have a chance at safety. Which, I also have to say, having been to the Met, I think I know what temple she's talking about, and that's so cool.
Oh, God, it's been a long time since I've been
like,
at the Met.
There's, like, a glass wall, and there's a giant, like, structure in this room with, like, the water around it.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that's the temple, because I don't think there's another, like, actual structure in
okay.
the Met. But, yeah, the last time I was there, we definitely walked around that thing and, like, got into it a little. So,
yeah.
like, it's kind of cool.
The only thing I can picture is the last museum I went to, which was in Detroit, which also had a lot of Egyptian stuff. So that's the only thing that's, like, in my mind right now. But that's, yeah, that's really cool.
But that pretty much wraps up the chapter, as we said. Not a whole lot happens, but just a few things worth noting. And there was a really good conversation in there between Bast and Carter. So
mm-hmm.
definitely worth talking about. But now we've got our favorite quotes and our favorite moments from this chapter. My favorite quote we already talked about, but I'm going to quote it one more time because it's so good. It was Bast saying, "Evil and good may not be the best way to think of it, Carter. As a magician, you must think about chaos and order."
Mm-hmm.
It's just so good.
It's good.
Yeah.
What was your favorite quote?
Mine was the opening line of the chapter when they're, like, switching mics, switching narrators, and Carter says, "Sorry, she keeps trying to distract me by setting fire to my..." Never mind. And I'm like, I feel like he was going to say setting fire to my butt, because that would have been,
or
like...
Or pants.
Yeah. That would have been, like, the funniest thing.
Yep, that's kind of what I thought, too. Like, yeah. She's sitting behind him.
Love that they're telling this very important story, and also possibly, like, on the run from something else, and, like, they're still just squabbling like siblings.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It never ends.
And then favorite moments. Mine was the cats swarming the carriers en masse. It's a really distinct visual, especially after, like, some Catwoman stuff in Batman. Mm. Like, there are moments where there's multiple cats, like, running after a bad guy or whatever, and it just formed a very specific thought in my head, and I could see it, so I thought that was really fun. What was your favorite moment?
Mine was Bast's giant glowing battle magic form, because one, it was green, and I love green, and two, it did remind me of the Jaegers from Pacific Rim, and it was just a great visual, and hey, we should be getting that in the movie if the movie gets made.
It's true.
So that's very exciting. And all the cats.
Yeah, and all the
cats. It's a lot of CGI cats. Or maybe real cats.
I want
probably
real cats.
Probably.
I want a real cat.
Have you ever heard the phrase, herding cats? Probably going to be difficult to have real cats.
It's literally a descriptor for how hard something is. So, yeah, we'll see. I don't know. Maybe they're trained. Maybe Hollywood has a horde of trained cats that will herd very well. I don't know.
That would be cool.
It could happen. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts as well. Tune in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions of your favorite canceled and cult classic TV shows, such as Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and more. Not About the Weather is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. And finally, Not Another Teen Wolf podcast features interviews with the cast and creators and has discussed every episode of the show, as well as the movie, and Jeff Davis's new show, Wolfpack, is currently getting the same treatment. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us long-form thoughts or whatever to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us and our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and that's a really big help. You can leave questions or comments or ideas for episodes and content you want to hear from us in any of these places. We do our best to keep up and make sure everything gets checked pretty frequently, so we appreciate hearing from you guys. This week, we do have a little bit of feedback on Twitter and an email. Should we start with Twitter and just get that one done really quick?
Sure.
I just thought it was really lovely. Our friend of the podcast, Ian Davies, he's a very active listener, and we love hearing from
him. When we say friend of the podcast, it's usually people who, like, talk to us regularly.
Right.
And we just want to be like, they're our friends.
We appreciate your interactions.
Yes.
We really, really do. But Ian Davies at @ensign_Davies says, finished off the fantastic The Sun and the Star last night. I couldn't stop, and it ended up being a very late one. Thank you at Mark Does Stuff and Rick Riordan. There were so many tears, but it was worth it. Now I can listen to Prophecy Podcast's episode on it. And I just was, we're tagged in good company, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Yeah, it's really awesome. So glad. And, like, that's a good thing about podcasts is, like, we read a lot of books on this podcast, and you're not going to keep up with us all the time. Same thing with the chapters, but you can always pause and go back, or, like, skip one and go back. As long as you go back, no, I'm just kidding. You can skip as many as you want, but it's really nice to know that, like, you know, he couldn't finish it until now, but now he gets to go back and experience our very long episode.
Yes.
So
we hope you enjoy.
Yes.
The 2.5-hour long podcast.
Yeah.
Whew, that was a long one. But yeah, we also got an email, and I will send this over to Karen.
Yes, this is from Shannon Kay, and I just really, really loved this email. She writes, I just wanted to email in while I'm still in my 30s. I have a few weeks left. I don't know when your birthday is, but happy birthday. I've been reading Percy Jackson books since, checks Goodreads, 2009, and I've been an adult the whole time. Sometime between then and now, I had 3 children. I'm still loving all the books in the Percy Jackson universe. course. I've been really enjoying your podcast. I also loved that your first episode was titled Two Old Ladies Start a Podcast, and how, if I recall correctly, you referred to yourselves as 30 Mumble Mumble. I think we did.
I'm pretty sure we did.
Also, we've gotten so many compliments on Two Old Ladies Start a Podcast, and you should have heard the discussions about what our first episode was going to be called.
Oh, yeah.
We went through a lot of iterations, and I am so proud of what we landed on.
Me too. I love it.
Yeah. She says, I don't get to listen as much as I'd like, but when I do, it's a delight. With regards to the Percibeth pep talk scene in The Sun and the Star, did anyone else immediately think that Percy looked somewhat disheveled because obviously they were making out? Highlight attached. And it does say, like, Percy himself looks somewhat disheveled, too, as in Annabeth did as well. So they are either studying very hard or just not studying at all.
They're taking a break.
Yeah, yeah. Breaks are important.
Couple break.
Yeah. I was also excited to learn from your podcast, probably last year, that Rick and Becky's birthday and anniversary is June 5th. That's coming up very soon.
Mm-hmm.
My birthday is June 6th. You did tell me when your birthday is. My best friend Deidre's birthday is June 7th. And your mom's birthday is June 7th.
Yep. A lot of big birthdays all at once.
Yeah. So that's very exciting. We can all celebrate together. That's really awesome. I also want to say, well, thank you very much, Shannon, for writing in. That... We love the feedback, but, like, especially when people are like, thank you for doing a podcast for, like, older people, I really love that. Because sometimes you do feel like, oh, I'm surrounded by a bunch of 20-year-olds or a bunch of teenagers who love Percy Jackson and great for them, but, like, I'm holding on to that magic that I discovered years ago, so.
Yeah, it's lovely to share it with the younger generations, and it really is. We want them to experience it because they're so good and we love them, but... There's nothing like kind of finding people your age that are still reading them. It's like, oh, okay, it's not just me. Like, there's plenty of people, 30-something, 40-something, that are, you know, big fans of this world and these books. And I love that we're all just still hanging out, holding tight. Like, we can stay together.
Yeah. I also just wanted to mention really quick, because she included her website in the email, shannonk.com/books, and it links to her Instagram account, Pink Books Coffee, and she has some very, like, clean, simple pictures of, like, coffee and books, and she has The Sun and the Star in one of them, and some really good, like, reads for some of these books, which is really cool. But I love bookstagrammers and obviously anybody who likes to read. So very cool. Give her a follow if you're into that sort of thing.
Thanks, Shannon. Okay, so that brings us to what are we going to talk about next week?
This
the answer is not the last canto of the day.
Yeah, this one's pretty set in stone.
Yeah. So next week, we are going to talk about Last Fallen Moon by Gracie Hamm. And by next week, I mean sooner. We're going to try and get back on our regular schedule.
Yes.
So if you're listening to this as it comes out, you'll have another episode in just a couple of days, hopefully. We're going to talk about Last Fallen Moon by Gracie Hamm, and we are also going to do a chapter of The Red Pyramid, so chapter 11 will be on there as well. But yeah, we're looking forward to talking about Last Fallen Moon so that we can get ready for The Last Fallen Realm, since I have not read either of them. I'm currently working on Moon, and I'm looking forward to Realm 2, so... That is as far as we have planned.
Yes.
The next week, we're still not entirely sure how things are going to pan out. So, but for now, we definitely can stick to that as our plan.
Yeah, and I haven't read Last Fallen Moon in a year, so it's going to be really nice to revisit it and have Kristen lead the discussion because I don't remember everything. So it'll be nice to sit back a little bit and be like, oh yeah, I totally remember that when I really don't. But
That was news to Kristen.
Yeah.
In case anyone wasn't sure, I didn't know that's how things were going down, but this is going to be fun. Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.